Christ to comfort me.
Christ to cherish me.
Christ to win me. Christ to keep me.
I arise today
through a mighty strength.
Through the invocation of the Trinity,
I bind unto myself
the power of the one in three,
Father,
Spirit,
Christ,
my only hope, my fondest desire, my salvation.
Maybe the least known remnant of St. Patrick on this St. Patrick's Day is called Patrick's Breastplate, a rather long Christ hymn that is attributed to this ancient missionary. On this St. Patrick's Day, the 17th of March, we're going to be talking about St. Patrick with Dr. Thomas von Hegel here in the first half hour of Issues, Etc. St. Patrick is, I dare say there's more to the celebration of St. Patrick, his life, his faith, his confession, than green beer, shamrocks, and pretending to be Irish for a day. We'll find out what more there is in the first half hour. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. As I said, it's Monday, March the 17th, and you can join us for the next 3 hours of the program. Our call-in number is 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, or you can email us, issuesetc@kfuo.org, and we'll get your questions or comments via email right here in the studio. Dr. Christopher Tollefson will be our guest for the second half hour. Very interesting, I think, probably landmark book that he has co-authored with Robert George called Embryo, A Defense of Human Life. Can you make an argument, apart from religious concerns, philosophical, scientific argument, that the embryo is a human being deserving of full protection and fundamentally the right to life? And how is the right to life different than all other rights that we talk about? We'll answer that question in about a half hour here on Issues, Etc. Dr. James Hitchcock of St. Louis University will join us to talk about two issues at 4 o'clock, the excommunication of two Roman Catholic women who were allegedly ordained as priestesses. And we'll also talk with Dr. Hitchcock about the kidnapping and the murder of a Catholic archbishop in Iraq. The Pope has responded as early as this morning, I believe, to that murder and to that kidnap, and we'll play some of that for you if time permits. Dr. Barrett Duke will join us at 4:25. We'll spend some time talking with him, talking about a recent statement by several Southern Baptist leaders on the environment. He's Vice President of Public Policy and Research at the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Commission. And then, of course, everyone else is talking about this. We probably should have a stab at it as well. Barack Obama, who's running for president, has discovered that perhaps one of the weaknesses in his public persona is not so much in his public persona, but that of his pastors, or we should say his erstwhile pastors. Jeremiah Wright, pastor of a very famous church in Chicago, is Barack Obama's pastor. At least he's headed toward retirement. And he said some things that really do make news. We'll see what you think about it in the last part of Issues, Etc. today. 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Thomas von Hegel is Associate Professor of Theology at Concordia University, Chicago, author of the book One Lord, One Faith, One Baptism, Christian Through the Centuries. Dr. von Hegel, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for having me.
Now, St. Patrick is associated with all sorts of silliness, usually debauchery and drunkenness. We've even got some green beads hanging around one of the doorknobs at the Wilkin House. I don't know where they came from, but my wife said, do you need these before you leave? And I said, I don't think so. But how has it come that a missionary, a person who's known primarily for his missionary zeal, has a day that is celebrated, at least here in the United States, as kind of Irish Day?
Yeah, I feel like a pattern's developing. Last month I was on for St. Valentine's Day. So you try to talk about St. Valentine, and then in the context of all of the contemporary American practices, and have a little bit of the same with St. Patrick as well, this wonderful bishop and missionary, and somewhat of an extraordinary leader of the Christian faith in Ireland. And yeah, we're at the point today where folks aren't really too interested in Patrick at all, but rather, as you rather generously said, the silliness that goes along with them. So, I mean, Patrick, of course, is a historical figure. He was Bishop of Ireland, very much concerned about the souls, both of his people and those outside the Christian faith, and very much wanting to speak the message of Jesus and the gospel to all in his area that they might have salvation in Christ.
We began the program by listening to the very tail end of what's called Patrick's Breastplate, a Christ hymn that is attributed to him. First of all, how reliably is this long hymn on the Trinity and on the Christ attributed to Patrick himself?
Of course, scholars debate these things. In terms of Patrick's literature that he would have wrote, he wrote a book called The Confession, which is much shorter, very much shorter, but somewhat styled after St. Augustine's Confessions, autobiographical, a bit apologetic, defending his life. He also wrote a letter to some soldiers who came through and slaughtered some Christians and took a few of them captive and such, and writes a scathing letter to them. And most scholars agree that those are probably Patrick's writings and pretty much as he would have wrote in his day. Most other things are pretty much probably not by Patrick. Maybe a little bit of there's some canons, the kind of the rules and regulations of the church that came out in his day that he might have had a bit of a hand in, and maybe other bishops of the day in following him. Most other things that are attributed to him, he may have had a bit of a hand in, but it probably appears that they were written after him. The same with the breastplate that you said you were just listening to previously.
Yeah, we began the show with just a brief recitation of the very last stanza, and probably most famous stanza of that breastplate there, where he talks about binding himself in Christ before him and Christ behind him.
Right, right. Yeah, and the hymn. Yeah, that. Yeah, wonderful. It certainly is not. I mean, it's. Patrick seemed to be very much a confessor of the Christian faith and the doctrine of the Holy Trinity. So if it's even if it didn't, wasn't penned by his own hand, it certainly is not unfaithful to his teachings. But I don't know that scholars want to necessarily ascribe it to his name.
Now let's talk in terms of its theology, about the idea of the Trinity, this uniquely Christian concept of God from Scripture, in a pagan Europe. How important would that have been for Patrick as a bishop, but also as a missionary, in proclaiming the true God in a pagan world?
Yeah, in our day-to-day, of course, in America, most people are Christian or at least heard of Christianity, so the doctrine of the Holy Trinity is not terribly outlandish, and maybe that's a problem with Christianity today. It sounds so kind of normal and acceptable. In pagan Europe, in Patrick's day, there were, of course, any number of competitive religions, and of course, we're not just talking about different Christian denominations. Instead, we're referring to different religions, and so in Ireland, you had the Druids, who were a pagan religion of the day, and so the doctrine of the Holy Trinity would have been quite different, rather reprehensible, and even ridiculed and chided by other religions. One of the legends that have come down to us today is the St. Patrick using the three-leaf clover as kind of an object lesson of the doctrine of the Holy Trinity, and whether or not he actually used the shamrock or not, it does serve as a nice illustration, because if in fact Patrick did, the Druids of his day they often attached symbolism to numbers, and three was rather important, whether it was three standing for the sky and the earth and the water, or the the mind and the life and the body, or the quarter moon, the half and the full moon, and you know, or the old, new, and quarter moon, and so to kind of be able to teach the Christian faith while at the same time you're taking a shot at the faith of the contemporary religion of the day, it really harks at a bit of genius and not having to kind of recreate the wheel, but to take the number three and a symbol that's, or you know, an illustration that people are used to, and what Christianity has often done, they take common understandings and practices and images of the day and simply baptize them, you know, kind of wash away the filth and sin of the contemporary culture's understanding of it, and then simply apply the Christian understanding of it, something so nice and simple, you know, the three leaves of the shamrock, three persons of the Holy Trinity, and yet it's just one shamrock and one God, and you know, it also fits in with Patrick himself. He wasn't terribly educated. Others often derided him for his lack of education. But at the same time, when it comes to the doctrine of the Holy Trinity, we, no matter how intelligent we are or are not, we never fully understand it. It's still at its best very basic and simple in our understanding and faith. So I'm not sure where we started, but I'll let you jump back in.
I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. Live this Monday, March the 17th. We're talking about St. Patrick on this St. Patrick's Day. Dr. Thomas von Hagel is our guest. You can join us with questions or comments. 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, or email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. In about 10 minutes, we'll discuss scientific and philosophical arguments in defense of the unborn with Dr. Chris Tollefson, who is co-author of the book Embryo, A Defense of Human Life. Now, legends that accrue to people like Patrick may not be entirely historical, but they are sometimes fascinating and they can be insightful as to the legacy of someone like this great missionary, St. Patrick. I wanted you to talk briefly about how he came to be the Bishop of Ireland, kind of roundabout circumstances, and take us through to his death, what we do know, if however uncertain.
It seems pretty certain that he was raised in Britain and was taken captive. You know, you have the local chieftains have various raids, and they go into an area and kill people and take some youngsters and take them back to their home area and enslave them, or might even later marry them into their people and such. And he's taken to Ireland as a captive, and after, I think it's about 6 years or so as a captive, he has a vision. Takes the first boat he can get a hold of over to the, you know, continent, Europe. He studies in Gaul a bit. Once the teacher that he had in Gaul goes over to Britain and becomes a rather significant person, he wants to send Patrick to be the bishop of Ireland, but folks aren't too excited about Patrick. One, he's not terribly educated, as I mentioned earlier. In fact, he even refers to his rusticity, being rather rustic, not well educated. And then just about when the vote comes up, he had confided to a fellow Christian about a grievous sin he had committed in his youth. And this then was told to the group, and so there seemed to be more opposed to him becoming bishop than not, Palladius was sent as the bishop to Ireland. Within a year, Palladius dies, and then Patrick is sent. So he's not the first bishop of Ireland, but he's an important one. As I'd mentioned earlier, a great missionary zeal for the souls of the people of the land. And so he not only cares for the Christians, but is involved in extensive outreach to the to the pagans and the non-Christians of Ireland throughout the land as well. He's any number of stories attributed to him, some of the legends and such, you know, with the three-leaf clover and the snakes leaving the land and miracles that he may have performed and such, wide variety of those. But he certainly was a historical figure, and he certainly was a good Christian bishop. Historically, he probably was arrested a few times and had to get himself out of some of those tight squeezes. Very much concerned with monks and so forth working throughout the countryside. You'd asked about his death. At least one of the early lives of Patrick speak about, at the end of his life comes about, and you have the monks gathered, the clergy gathered around him singing. I mean, that's what else can Christians do when the soul of a fellow Christian is about ready to leave this veil of sorrow or tears and ascend into the glories of eternal life. It's a bit sorrowful, but it's also a time for joy and celebration. And one of the poems of his life by Fiac, like I say, an early 5th century poem of his life, speaks about that. That while the clergy on earth are hymning to God, that the chorus of angels above are singing in unison as they're waiting for him to die and take his soul off to eternal life in heaven. At least that's one of the stories. I'm not sure if you were fishing for something else, but I'll let you jump back in. And
the talk a bit about Patrick is known in his time as practicing kind of a severe form of asceticism, this kind of very disciplined life. And in addition to Patrick's peculiar practices of it, why were the early Christians, even here up until the 4th century, why did many of them consider this in some ways an essential part of their Christian piety, the ascetic life?
Yeah, the Christians have always wanted to live a life that is like unto Christ. So today, for many Christians, it's whether it's trust in God, morality, faith, but other forms as well. So, for example, in the early church, when the church was being persecuted, you had Christ and His Passion, which, of course, we're right in the midst now of Holy Week, and so Christians that were martyrs were persecuted and were able to live a life like unto Christ's passion. Not every Christian, but those who were persecuted and martyrs were. In 313, with the Edict of Milan and Constantine, allowing the Christian church to be tolerated and then later to work its way a little more significantly into the Roman Empire, that passion, that being persecuted and being a martyr like unto Christ was lost. And so Christians began to look for other ways to live a life like unto Christ. So Christ was not married and celibate, and so some Christians would live that way. Christ often fasted, went off into the wilderness and prayed, and so other Christians would live that type of life. Christ lived a life of poverty. And so when you have ascetics and monks and nuns and hermits, they say, well, they want to live a life like Christ. We can't be put to death like the martyrs were and live like Christ according to His passion. So maybe we can live our lives like Christ by being celibates, by being impoverished, by praying and fasting quite a bit, by serving our neighbor extensively. And so you see then a variety of ascetic. Asceticism is simply Christians who wish to exercise their Christian faith, and all Christians do in one manner or another. What the people we call ascetics, monks and nuns, usually do it in this prayer and fasting and celibacy and poverty and taking a vow and such, and so Christians often look to the ascetics, these monks and nuns, as as Christians to look up to, as folks who are setting aside the, you know, their bank accounts and their summer vacation homes and retirement accounts and fully devote their life to serving Christ and the church and their fellow man. And Patrick was one of these folks, supposedly lived a very, very rigorous life, not allowing himself to have luxuries of fine clothes or warm beds or good foods and such, but slept on the ground with a rock as his pillow and would chastise his flesh from time to time, lest his sinful flesh take over and rule his life. And so kind of that, where Paul talks in Romans 7 and 8 about the constant battle of the flesh and the spirit, ascetics and Patrick would just take it a bit literal and literally try to assail and crucify the flesh and thus the sinful and fleshly desires of it in their lives.
Then with only about 30 seconds here, why is it important that Christians today understand their history even as ancient as that of Patrick, with about 30 seconds?
Well, certainly while things change in terms of time and place and people, in one sense, in another sense, things never change at all. While St. Patrick was concerned about preaching the message of Jesus and the gospel to the pagans of his day, there's really very little difference today. Even though we live in a supposedly Christianized country, there are literally pagans around us, and there are others who have no religion at all, and whether they know it or not, are simply not Christians and pagans as well. And so to take that zeal that Patrick had, and that ability, like with the shamrock, and take a very simple, ordinary object and give a Christian spin to it as he speaks the message of Jesus and the gospel, it's certainly a model we can learn from and apply in our lives today.
Dr. Thomas von Hagel is Associate Professor of Theology at Concordia University, Chicago, author of the book One Lord, One Faith, One Baptism, Christians Through the Centuries. You can find out more about this book by calling Concordia Publishing House. It is a very easily read and popularly written encyclopedia, if you will, of the high points in Christian history and the people who occupied those points. It's called One Lord, One Faith, One Baptism, Christians Through the Centuries. Call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go to their website, www.cph.org. One Lord, One Faith, One Baptism by Dr. Thomas von Hagel. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back from this break, we're going to turn our attention to the subject of The Defense of the Unborn, very excellent new book, co-authored by our guest in the next half hour, Dr. Christopher Tollefson, called Embryo, A Defense of Human Life. Many times on this program, with many guests, as we've defended life from beginning to end, we have made the point that the center of the debate, especially on abortion, but on all other life issues pertaining to the unborn, is the unborn, is the embryo. We'll talk about the embryo after this.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you want more of God's grace? Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois is a Bible-believing church faithful to the Scriptures, a place for the whole family, a community that cares with a vibrant, historic Christian liturgy. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church is located at 612 North State Street in Freeburg. Their phone number, 618-539-5664. Christ-centered, cross-focused, Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg.
On the next edition of Focus on the Family, Joe Dallas brings a convicting message about homosexuality and the church.
We have the responsibility to be consistent. We have the responsibility to be compassionate, especially towards those who oppose us.
How are Christians called to respond to the homosexual? Find out on the next Focus on the Family with Dr. James Dobson.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Abortion Lie Number 2.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Many women facing an unplanned pregnancy believe that abortion is all about choice. Even though this word is closely identified with abortion, often women report that a lack of perceived choices led them to view abortion as their only option. Faced with insecurities at school and at work and fearing a loss of important relationships, women choose abortion. So in reality, it is too often the perceived absence of choice that causes a woman to take the life of her unborn child. Pregnancy resource centers do valuable work in helping women see the true scope of their options.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. For more about our work to mobilize and advance pro-life women in politics, visit our website at sba-list.org.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, where values thrive, and online at thrivent.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. The color these days is green. Green, of course, for St. Patrick's Day, commemorating the tradition that Patrick of the 4th century brought the gospel to Ireland. That was more than the luck of the Irish. It was the care of a loving God for one people in a world of people suffering under sin. Green these days because of Palm Sunday, celebrated yesterday in Christian churches. Zechariah 9 verse 9 says, "Everyone in Jerusalem, celebrate and shout. Your king has won a victory, and he is coming to you. He is humble and rides on a donkey. He comes on the colt of a donkey." The crowds lining the streets for Jesus' entry to Jerusalem were into green, waving palm branches, symbols of victory. From joyous green on Sunday to dark death on Good Friday, the colors of Holy Week get darker. That's the pattern for us mortals as well. The grass withers, the flower fades. Isaiah 40, verse 8. Unless Jesus' story is your story, the colors will stay dark. Revelation chapter 7 says, "I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, 'Salvation belongs to our God, who sits on the throne, and to the Lamb.'"
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, online at thrivent.com. We do more than work. We work with a purpose.
What I have tried to talk about and reach out about in talking about abortion being safe, legal, and rare, and by rare, I mean rare.
Abortion is a deeply moral issue. The reason that I make a decision to support the choice position is not because I don't think it's a moral issue, but because I trust women to make a prayerful decision.
The two Democratic candidates for president, at least as for the time being, chiming in on their, it sounds like some ambivalence, moral ambivalence about the choice that is abortion for the next half hour of issues, etc. What kind of a moral choice is it? What kind of a debate is it? We talk about a woman's right to choose or a woman's choice. We talk about wanting to have abortion be safe, legal, and rare, but if it is a right, why would we want it to be rare? And if this right to choice infringes upon another more fundamental right, what are we to do? We're going to talk about scientific and philosophical arguments in defense of the unborn. Dr. Christopher Tolleson joins us. He's associate professor of philosophy at the University of South Carolina and co-author of the new book, Embryo, A Defense of Human Life. You can join us as well, 1-800-730-2727. We're coming to you live this Monday, March the 17th, 505-7850, or email your questions or comments to issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Tolleson, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Nice to be here.
How is the right to life unique among all other human rights that we may discuss?
Well, the right to life certainly seems like it's the foundational one. If you don't have that, if that right isn't respected, then none of the other rights that you have are really going to make much of a difference. And at the same time, in a kind of profoundly sad way, it's the right that seems to be most easily eclipsed for arbitrary reasons like the size that you are, or the stage of development that you're at, or in other times and places, the color of your skin, or what race you come from.
You have written, human beings are perfectly capable of understanding that it is morally wrong and unjust to treat embryonic human beings as less than fully human. We need religion to support such claims in this domain, no more than we need religion to support claims of racial justice or the rights of the disabled. What are you saying there?
Well, what we're trying to say, I think, is that, first of all, everybody really has the moral capacity to understand that all human beings need to be treated in a fundamentally equal way, that all human beings have a right to life. The second claim that we want to make is that all of us have the capacity to understand that right from the earliest stages of our development, from the embryonic stage, from that single-celled stage, what we have is indeed an individual human being. Everybody can recognize that if they go and look at the basic embryology books. And with those two claims in mind, everybody is capable of making the moral judgment. Now, we don't want to deny, and I think this is really important, that morality or that religion plays a very important role right at this juncture. Even though people are capable of recognizing very basic and very obvious moral truths, it can be very hard for us to live up to those. And religion is very important, I think, for motivating people to do the right thing, to hold on to the right thing, even in the face of social pressures to the contrary.
You discuss later in your book that the philosophical and moral arguments and scientific arguments about the embryo are perhaps sufficient in and of themselves to be guides and the basis for public policy, mm-hmm. for legal policies. What do you mean by that?
That's right. Well, I think that we can have, I mean, suppose that we had a society that had abandoned religion or had abandoned Christianity, it would still be a society that needed to make reasonable judgments about who to protect with its laws, or else there would be no society at all. And I think everybody is capable of recognizing that if the protection of the laws is given only in an arbitrary way, then the laws are not really succeeding in their proper function. And so we think that everybody at that point would say, oh, you know what? What's important is being a human being. That's the scope of the law. That's where our public policy needs to expand out to. And anything other than that is going to be discriminatory in some way.
What is the sad state, but if you would, what is the moral status of the embryo today in the United States, especially vis-a-vis laws pertaining to abortion?
Sure. Well, I think you're absolutely right. It's a very sad state. I think it's a tragic state because it's one in which we have a tremendous part of our human population, members of the human family, that are completely disenfranchised by law. They're not counted as persons. They're not given the protection of the law. And in consequence, people are enabled under cover of law to make decisions that many of them later regret, that many of them are pressured into. And if embryonic stem cell research were to continue, for instance, if we were to have embryo-destructive research on a wide scale, then under protection of the law and, in fact, funded probably by taxpayer money, we would have a situation in which there was just a tremendous amount of violation of human rights, human life, and everybody would be paying the price for that.
What is consequentialism?
Oh, that's a bad one. Consequentialism is a moral theory, and probably among professional philosophers, it's probably the top moral theory. It's the one that everybody professes most adherence to, and it's simply put the view that we should be guided in making our choices by what will bring about the best overall consequences. And one thing that I think jumps out at you, if you think about that, is that what that means is that the value of the individual can be trumped by the value of the whole. And so it's probably a good thing to think of it during Holy Week. This is really Caiaphas's maxim, that it's better for one person to suffer than that the whole community should suffer.
Hmm. How does that differ from utilitarianism, the end justifies the means?
Sure. Utilitarianism is just one instance of consequentialism. Historically, utilitarians were concerned to say that the particular good that should be promoted is the good of pleasure. And there again, I think we can see there are obvious problems. Everybody recognizes that there are some pleasures that are just not good to be pursued, and that if we rank all pleasures as equal and say, well, we just want to bring about the best, then that's going to result in a pretty horrific state of affairs.
So let me see if I have the picture here. Whether a person knows it or not, whether a person is a lawmaker or someone who executes justice, or whether it's the person on the street, the woman who stands outside the abortion clinic, wrestling with her conscience about whether or not to go in. One way or the other, the argument that the embryonic human being does not deserve to be protected formally or informally in our society is a direct result of someone saying there's a better the better outcome that I can foresee allows me to disregard the embryonic human being.
I think that's a big part of it. I think it's linked to one other, especially where abortion is concerned, maybe less so where embryo destructive research is concerned. I think a second part to the picture really is that we live in a world in which the value of liberty has been promoted and allowed to eclipse maybe all other values, but certainly in some cases the value of human life. And I think you can see that as tying into consequentialism. If you think that liberty is such a good value, then you're going to want to maximize that, and so abortion, liberal abortion laws are going to seem reasonable. But it can also be the case that I think some people just focus on that value of liberty and say, look, this is the only value, and we need to allow women to have that particular liberty to abort their children.
Have we, in fact, replaced the fundamental right that is life and the protections that drive therefrom for human beings of all the stages of development with the right to liberty?
Yeah,
have we substituted one for the other?
I think in many cases that's right. And, of course, we wouldn't want to deny that liberty is extremely important, right? It's very important that people be able to make choices both for the sake of morality, right? We're better moral people when we're allowed to make the right moral choice, but also for the sake of our own growth and development. But we shouldn't enshrine that possibility, that right to liberty, as the only one that counts, and certainly not when it comes at the expense of other human beings.
Can you have a coherent system of human rights, a coherent way of thinking about human rights and dignity, if the foundational prevailing right is always personal liberty?
No, I don't think that you can. And we can see this even if we were just to run through, I think, a little bit further, what would happen if everybody were granted the most possible liberty that they can have, then society would again start to crumble. Nobody would be capable of getting along. But I think we see this just by reflecting on some of the things that we take to be foundationally important. Marriage, for instance, the good of marriage, isn't all about a maximization of liberty. If a couple thought that that was the case, they would have a very short and very disastrous marriage. So liberty right there, we see that it's something that's very important to us, that's very central to our conception of goods, but that comes into conflict in certain ways with the ultimate enshrinement of liberty.
You write a lot about dualism, and the one that I'd like you to talk about is what you call the person-body or self-body dualism. What is this concept, and how do we combat it in terms of scientific and philosophical argumentation?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think this is a really difficult issue. What we want to say, what we want to address, is a misunderstanding about the nature of the human person. Right? What kind of beings are we? And what we want to say in our book and what we try to argue for is that although we're very special kinds of beings, we have reason and we have free choice, and in that respect we're made in the image of God, we're also essentially bodily beings. We're organic beings. We're human animals, and that's central to who and what we are. If we were to deny that, if we were to think that we're some sort of either immaterial object entirely or perhaps just a part of the human being, just the brain, for instance, then we would. It might make sense to us to think that we were never ourselves embryos, we were never ourselves fetuses, that the immaterial being that we are didn't come into existence until somewhat later. Now, we don't want to deny the existence of a soul, for instance, but we do want to say that our bodily nature is central to what we are. And again, I think we see this in Holy Week. It's very, very interesting to see that what we're all leading up to is the focus on the resurrection of the risen Lord and in his bodily nature. And I think that tells us something important about what we are.
So the person-body dualism would say that the person somehow can exist apart from the body and vice versa. And you would say this is a disastrous way of conceiving of ourselves.
That's right. That's right. And here's one example of the disaster that ensues. If you think that's the case, then you can have many, many cases in which the bodily existence continues to live on, but people will say, well, the person is gone. And we see this case, for instance, when we get to people in persistent vegetative states, the idea that because these people aren't conscious, that they're no longer persons, even if they're living individual human beings. If they're no longer persons, then, of course, it's going to follow that they don't get the respect due to persons, including the right to life.
Dr. Christopher Tollefson is our guest. We're talking about the scientific and philosophical arguments in defense of the embryo. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of South Carolina, co-author of the new book, Embryo, A Defense of Human Life. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our call-in number, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It's Monday, March the 17th, and we're coming to you live. I'm Todd Wilkin. In about 20 minutes, we'll discuss the excommunication of two Roman Catholic priestesses, or at least that's what they purport to be, with Dr. James Hitchcock of St. Louis University. When it comes to the embryo itself, can we set side by side how the person who accepts this person-body dualism would tend to view the embryonic human being? And then what does the science about what the embryo is argue against that dualism?
Sure. Well, if we ask ourselves, what are we? What are you and I? And we were to answer ourselves to ourselves, well, what we are is some sort of non-bodily being, then we're going to look at the embryo, and we're going to notice various differences that the embryo has from us. The embryo is not at that moment capable of thinking. It's not at that moment capable of choosing. It's not at that moment capable of entering into active relationships with other people. And so we might be inclined then to say, well, that embryo isn't the same sort of thing as I am. It's not a person. Right? And then, of course, the embryo will be available to us for exploitative purposes. We'll be able to use it for scientific research. Now, if we think what I am is a human being, right, if we accept that, if we accept that there really is an essential bodily element to our existence, then we need to ask the question, well, when did I come into existence? When did I start to begin? And there's where we think science is so very important. The latest embryological science, if you look at any embryology textbook, for instance, it all indicates the same thing. It all indicates that we came into existence when a sperm penetrated an egg and a new distinct individual came into existence, genetically different from the mother and father, and possessing within itself its own internal program for its own self-development and growth to the next stage of the being of a human being.
How forceful do you think the argument is? And it seems a simple argument, but it sounds like it is a great part of yours, that all of us were once the embryo. Through every stage of development, we were all at once a fertilized egg. We were all once the two cells together. We were all once a blastocyst. We were all once that, and now I am who I am. And there is no logical way of getting around that that was me.
That's right. And I think it's very difficult, if we think about it, to imagine ourselves saying of some being at a particular time, well, sure, that was me, but it would have been okay for somebody to kill me at that point. There's some particular point in my life where it would have been okay for the sake of the greater good or for scientific progress or because of somebody's convenience for them to have just killed me. I don't think any of us really think about the stages of what we take to be our lives in that way. We think that all stages of our lives are equally important and that we should be given moral respect during all those stages. And so that's why I think it's so important for us to recognize that one of those stages in our lives was the embryonic stage, just as one of those stages was the fetal stage, the infant stage, and the adolescent stage.
This is a rather daunting task ahead to somehow reorient people's thinking regarding human embryos as embryonic human beings in the fullest sense of the word, but also toward orienting them after 35 years of legalized abortion and now with embryonic stem cell research, that these human embryos deserve full protection of the law. How do we do it?
That's right. I think one big way that we need to do it is by getting some of that scientific information out there. I think something that was really very interesting in the recent news about these advances in stem cell technology, the induced pluripotent stem cell technology, where we can de-differentiate adult cells back to a pluripotent stage where they could become any cell of the human body. The scientists who were doing that, James Thompson of the University of Wisconsin and Shinya Yamanaka, who's a scientist in Japan, James Thompson was a person who originally was able to isolate embryonic stem cells. And both of them have done work in the past on human embryos. But after this new development came through, they both said some very interesting things. Thompson said to the New York Times, of all places, if destroying human embryos doesn't bother you, then you haven't really thought about it enough. And Yamanaka said that one of the reasons that he was interested in this new technology is because he had been looking at human embryos under a microscope, and he thought to himself, these are just not that different from my own children. Now, these are two scientists who have a tremendous amount of embryological and biological knowledge at their fingertips, and I think that was instrumental in getting them to see that there really are significant moral problems here, that there really are great difficulties in just taking the human embryo to be material that can be disposed of at will. This so I think that's a big part of it. We need to get some of that knowledge out there.
This is the one that puzzles me, and perhaps you can help me out. The response, and I've had listeners raise this objection, but we hear it in the public debate as well. Well, you know, it's all fine and good to come to a point where we won't have to use human embryos to get stem cells or be able to find other sources for them. But a lot of those sources, like the ones you just talked about, were only discovered because we were able to do experimentation on human embryos. So whether you're for it or against it, the new avenues for stem cells, with the exception of adult stem cells,
right,
required embryo experimentation. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't think that's actually true in the case of this most recent development, the induced pluripotent stem cell research, which is really just a tremendous development, and it really is revolutionary. And that research began for Yamanaka, for instance, with mouse research. And it looks like that was all that he needed, really, to both get the concept and then to put it into practice. And then he applied what he had done with mice to human beings. I think we need to be a little bit honest. It's certainly possible that some of the gains that we would hope to make with adult stem cell research, for instance, or with induced pluripotent stem cell research, some of those gains might be made faster if we were to engage in embryonic stem cell research. But, you know, we would probably make a lot more gains and a lot more rapid gains, for instance, in cancer research if we were enabled to do lethal research on cancer patients. And nobody, I think, is going to accept that. Nobody's going to think, oh, well, sure, if we can make better progress, then we should do that sort of research. Everybody recognizes that there are moral boundaries to science. And what we're trying to say is, look, this is one of those essential boundaries.
You conclude your book with three proposals, a political proposal, a technical proposal, and a cultural proposal. With about a minute here, summarize those for us, if you would.
Well, we think that as a nation, we really need to move very firmly and very rapidly in the direction of banning all embryo-destructive research. We also think that it's very important that assisted reproduction technology be much more strongly overseen by the federal government, to the point that it will not be the case, as it is now, that extra embryos are being created as part of assisted reproductive techniques. That would, I think, alleviate a lot of the problems that we have. And we think it's very important both that adult stem cell research and induced pluripotent stem cell research be promoted by the federal government, and also that individuals, churches, social groups make an effort in the direction of what we call embryo adoption. This is a concept that I think is becoming very familiar to a lot of people, that some of these embryos that are currently in frozen storage be rescued from that state and allowed to come to term and develop as human beings.
What is the strongest scientific argument in defense of the embryonic human being?
The strongest is that if you look at an embryo, the only thing, if you're a scientist, that you can see, I think this is borne out by many, many scientists' work, the only thing that you can see is an individual member of the same species that you and I belong to. It's just less developed in the same way that an infant is less developed than an adult, but it's got everything that it needs in order to progress down that path towards being an infant, towards being a teenager, towards being an adult, towards being somebody that everybody recognizes as a full member of the human family.
And what is the strongest philosophical argument in defense of the embryonic human being?
I think the strongest argument there is really a very simple moral argument. We need to know where the boundaries are for what and whom we're going to morally respect, and those boundaries should not be arbitrary. If we take something like consciousness or the ability to communicate, those are abilities that come on a continuum. Some people have more and some people have less. Some people get them earlier, some people get them later. If we're looking for a non-arbitrary boundary, which is really what fairness and justice demand, then the only place that we can find that is in the difference between entities that are not human beings, maybe they're just parts of human beings like a sperm and an egg, and entities that are human beings. And the fertilized egg, the human zygote, the one-celled conceptus, that is clearly an individual human being.
Do you see light at the end of the tunnel on any of these fronts?
Well, we live in such a difficult time that it's hard to be too optimistic, but I think this new technology, the induced pluripotent stem cell technology, has such hope that it really does give us, at least on the embryo research avenue, a possible option for solving some of our problems without moral compromise, which I think in this area is something that we really can't accept.
Dr. Christopher Tollefson is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of South Carolina. He's co-authored a new book titled Embryo, A Defense of Human Life. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks very much, Todd.
Folks, here's a way that you can help us defend life from beginning to end. You can get your congregation to join the Issues Etc. 300. It's very simple. We're looking for 300 congregations of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod to pledge $1,000 to the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. in their mission or advertising budgets. Now, to find out about the benefits of joining the Issues Etc. 300, go to our homepage, issuesetc.org. It's the Issues Etc. 300. Look for the LCMS logo. Find out how your congregation can include Issues Etc. in its mission or advertising budget and help support this worldwide outreach and defend life from beginning to end. The Issues Etc. 300. When we come back from this break, we've got hour two of Issues Etc. Dr. James Hitchcock will be our guest. Two stories in the news I'd like his response to. One is the kidnapping and the murder of a Catholic archbishop in Iraq. The Pope has responded to that. Also, the excommunication of two Roman Catholic women who were allegedly ordained as priests late last year and believed they were serving as priestesses. We'll talk about that with Dr. James Hitchcock, professor of history at St. Louis University. Then Dr. Barrett Duke will join us to talk about a recent statement by several Southern Baptist leaders on the environment, not to be confused with the Southern Baptist official statement on the environment. This one came with the signature of, I think, one present and several past presidents of the Southern Baptist Convention. We'll see what it has to say. And then we have audio open lines in the last part of the program. The controversy surrounding the sermons preached by the statements made by Senator Barack Obama's former pastor, Jeremiah Wright. He has some very eye and ear-raising things to say about race in America, about the place of the black person, about black liberation theology, and we'll see what you think about it in the last hour of Issues, etc. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, or email us, issuesetc@kfuo.org. It's Monday, March the 17th. Tomorrow on the program, Dr. Kirby Anderson will join us to talk about Islam. Dr. Christian Smith, author of the book Soul Searching, will be our guest Wednesday on the program. He is the researcher who came up with the, what was it again, therapeutic moral deism as the religion that most young people in the United States adhere to, whether they call themselves Christians or not. He says if you just look at their beliefs and the ideas that they associate with their religious beliefs, they are therapeutic moral deists, not necessarily Christians. We'll be talking with him Wednesday on the program. I know someone up in Casper, Wyoming, or Laramie, Wyoming, whichever it is, will be very happy to hear that we're talking about that soul-searching research. She's been on me about that for about 2 years, I think. So, finally, the wheels of Issues, etc., grind in the right direction. When we come back, we're going to talk about these two Roman Catholic women who have been excommunicated for submitting to invalid ordinations, putting themselves forth as priestesses in the Roman Catholic Church, and the tragic kidnapping and murder of a Catholic archbishop in Iraq. The Pope has reacted, saying the bloodshed must cease. We'll talk more about it after this.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.